first the Spanish government and then the Mexican government, essentially saying, come here and settle. The only rules, no slavery, you must learn Spanish, and ideally you must become Catholic. Now, the first thing we discover is that slavery was endemic and systematic and not abandoned at all in Texas. In fact, vast fields were planted in cotton. The cotton is a crop that you have to always expand your holdings because it eats up the nutrients in the soil.
Yes, particularly nitrogen.
Yeah, so it particularly becomes necessary to have more and more land in cotton. And this was true until we invented artificial fertilizers.
Yes.
At any rate, so Texas became a sort of a unacknowledged part of the United States during this period of time. Then essentially Mexico fought, arguing for the border of Texas at the Rio Nueces, not the Rio Bravo or Grande. And the United States provoked that war in the 1840s, 1846. And Abraham Lincoln became famous for saying, in objecting to the war, show me the spot on the map where American troops were attacked on American soil. And the insult that was heaped upon him at the time was Old Spot Lincoln, which was a name, standard name at that time for a doggy.
I see.
You see? Mm. So he was the son of a, you know. So, right? So this was part of our history. We celebrate the Alamo as a tragic event where brave Davy Crockett, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
all stood up against the vast armies, you know, and were defeated. And why? They were offered an opportunity to leave several times. You know, so it's been made into a John Wayne epic. And our history, our pop culture history of the relationship between the United States and Mexico is riven with these distortions of American history. The fact of the matter is that the United States, in an effort largely to expand slaveholding and to make a nation from coast to coast, decided to take over a half to a third, an exact number I'm not sure of Mexico.
Now, when you say the relationship between the United States and Mexico is riven by these misunderstandings of history, I think that's true. But I think you're also giving people too much credit. I think it's riven by plain old racism.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that.
Okay. I'm not arguing with you either.
I think racism is a very important part of this. And I want to just tell a quick story about my childhood.
Okay.
If you all will indulge me. When I was a kid, we moved a lot. My parents were peripatetic. And at one point, we ended up in a town called Temecula, which is a small, at that, in those days, now it's a suburb of San Diego and L.A., but it was a small western town dominated by the Vail Cattle Ranch. And all the workers that I knew of in the Vail Cattle Ranch in Temecula, this small town, right on the border of San Diego County and Riverside County. All of the workers there, just about, were braceros. That means legitimized Mexican workers brought into California starting in World War II in an effort to fulfill the need for agricultural workers while all other men were sent off. Now, I'm not going to spend a long time talking about the enormous race riots that took place in Los Angeles during that period called the Zoot Suit Riots in the 1940s. That's another topic for another day. But the racism was so endemic. I can remember in going to school, I went to a three-room schoolhouse. A huge number of these bracero children, well, a huge number is three or four because it was a tiny school, were, in fact, going to school with us. And they didn't wear shoes to school, which for me, coming out of L.A., was an amazing idea. What the deal was the families had sets of shoes for each age, which were saved and used for church and for important events in the life of the family. And to preserve those shoes, they weren't just used to knock around in the dirt and mud and dust of the semi-arid landscape. So the kids had very strong, leathery feet. And I remember one boy and I became pretty good friends. And I can remember where we would be dropped off, where the school bus stopped, where I had to wait for a ride home by my father. And the family, his family, took pity on me, offered me a meal, because sometimes my father would be late. And I was such a city boy. I was very reluctant to eat their food.
I bet it was really good.
Well, when I finally broke my fear, I realized, whoa, this is really cool. I'd never had, this is how isolated and urban I was. I'd never had normal, regular dinner in a Chicano household at that time. So this was the world I grew up in. I grew up in a world also where kids thought my family was wealthy, which it was not. But proof of that was there were two cars in our yard.
And you had shoes to wear every day.
And shoes every day. And, of course, the fact that we were Jewish proved our wealthiness.
Well, naturally.
Well, duh, you know. I mean, so that the racism was on two sides.
How you people are.
Yeah, the ignorance was pretty universal. That was the world I grew up in. When I went to San Diego High School, years later, I re-entered the world of Mexican-Americans. My first day of school, I was late to my geometry class, and I got braced by these kids in the hallway, and they were large men, and they said, give me your tabs. In those days, your school ID had tabs on the back that you used to get into, and you tore them off to get into the various football and basketball games and so on.
Hmm.
So they were a valuable item to bring people who weren't really students to see these games. And this guy said, give me your tabs. And I said, no, I haven't gotten my card yet, which was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabbed me and he pained me and another kid helped him and they were hurting me. And I was, and here I was, a little 14-year-old kid. And I looked up the stairs at these beautiful, beautiful women, young women,
mm-hmm.
in these, you have to imagine that era, in these huge skirts with dozens of crinolines under them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, such that the skirts rose up. So here is a young women standing above me, and I'm looking up at their lovely legs and thighs. Whoa, when I'm 14 years old, and I'm being hurt. And they look at me, the women look at me with a look of pity and disdain.
Oh, my.
I did the one thing boys cannot do. I burst into tears.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a formative moment.
Oh, man.
Oh, you're experiencing sex and pain at the same time, and then followed by humiliation. That really set the pattern for the rest of your life, didn't it?
No.
Oh.
But what it did, too, was make those guys let go of me, because in their cultural context, crying as an adult male, which came traditionally.
Close enough, you were, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, so that meant I must not have the tabs. So I got away, and I actually kept the tabs, and I could, I could say, well, yeah, I cried, and yeah, I'm chicken, and yeah, I'd let this happen, and yeah, and then but the fact of the matter is that I thought, oh, I got away with it. By crying, bad lesson. Anyway, this event set a pattern of my sense of the otherness of Mexican Americans. This otherness that persisted in an essentially segregated school.
But not a pattern of crying around women. It didn't set that pattern.
Why are you going there?
Because it's funny.
I guess I shouldn't have told that story.
Look, no, sorry, go ahead.
Really irrelevant. The really important point here is that I went to a high school called San Diego High School, which was built like, looked like a castle. It was very old, built in the 20s or something. It looked like a prison castle, you know, kind of serious, nasty place, big, heavy doors. And, of course, it had to be torn down for the earthquake-ness in the 1960s. And in that high school, when I came to school, it was a sophomore year, it was the first year of high school in San Diego County, and when I went to school, half the students were white, a quarter were Chicano, a quarter were African-American. When I graduated, almost all the students were white because they were the only ones that really stuck around to get the degree. And the three communities existed in uneasy alliance. College-bound kids, of whom there were a few among African Americans and a few among Mexican Americans, bonded with more or less the elites of the white community. But everyone
was this
else,
segregated San Diego?
Not formally.
Not formally.
Yeah, but when I went to Phoenix to visit for a football game, it was actually segregated. There was no rock and roll allowed.
Oh my!
Yeah. So this was the world of the 1950s.
That could lead to dancing.
That could lead to dancing. This was the world of the 1950s, and it was a totally isolating experience. Now, in that same context, at that same time, there had been a promise made to the Mexican-American community of Los Angeles after the Zoot Suit riots, after the viciousness of the attacks on Mexican-Americans and the branding of them as pachucos, you know, delinquent bad people with the cross between their thumb and forefinger. Oh, after all of that, Chavez Ravine in L.A. was to be made into housing, good quality housing for poor Hispanic people.
Ooh, that's not what it is today.
No. And what ended up happening is the Dodgers snuck out of Brooklyn and were given that self-same land for the Dodger Park, which is still there.
Dodger Stadium, yeah.
Dodger Stadium, still there. So this betrayal stayed with me, the awareness of it, the separation I felt, the curiosity I felt as well. I began to make a few friends amongst the Hispanic community and learned a little bit about marijuana and stuff like that, a little before my colleague, my contemporary student buddies. But always there was this otherness. Always there was a sense of a different community. And it wasn't only class. It was definitely a racist environment. Now, let's jump way ahead to now.
Okay.
Now, suddenly, not so suddenly, after many struggles, after the grape boycotts, after the creation of the unions for the farm workers, after Cesar Chavez, after all of that, we look at the situation of people who are multi-generational Americans of Spanish heritage. We realize, if we think at all about it, that all this land, California, Arizona, New Mexico, all of it was
Spanish-speaking.
Okay. We also discovered that the treaty made between the United States and Mexico at the end of the Spanish-American, of the Mexican-American War, a war provoked by the United States, was a treaty that promised all of those Hispanic people that their ancestral land charters and so on would be maintained, that they would not lose their land, particularly the wealthiest families, that they could continue to practice their religion, which was Catholicism, that they could continue to read and write and talk Spanish. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was violated from the day it was written. In fact, many county courthouses with records of old Spanish land grants mysteriously lost the land grants or, in fact, were burned down. So huge, huge numbers of people were disenfranchised. We jump further forward and we discover that during World War II, as I mentioned earlier, braceros were brought in deliberately to pick the fields, to do the farm work, to do the stiff, backbreaking labor. And many of those managed to stay on. The song we just heard, a Woody Guthrie song with Joan Baez singing it, is a song of an airplane that crashed full of people being deported to Mexico. Baez is of a Hispanic background. The whole history of the Southwest, the whole history of America, and of course, of places like New York, where large Puerto Rican communities exist, Puerto Rico being one of the places we got out of the Spanish-American War. The whole history of the region, riven with injustice, the enormity of it. So along comes Obama, and he makes a promise. He says, we're going to deal with this immigration problem.
Yes.
And what happens then?
Well, he's deported almost 2 million people.
More than anyone else in the similar period of time.
Yes. He has set a new bar for deportations. That's President of the United States.
And the deportations include just families, but it also includes somebody who might be arrested for a DUI or who might be arrested for speeding or any number of small crimes.
To understand this, it's helpful to jump back a little bit, not as far as you just did, but basically to September 11th, 2001.
Ah.
Immigration's always been a hot button issue, at least in recent decades, and it's been another of a long series of racist dog whistles that conservatives are able to sound. It's not okay to be an out-and-out public racist anymore, but it is okay to talk about things like law and order, as Nixon used to talk about, or welfare moms, as Reagan used to discuss. And now, of course, illegal immigration is a buzzword. All these things refer to people whose skin tone is decidedly darker than the white Anglo-Saxon tradition in this country. So there is this racist undercurrent to the immigration discussion that has always been there. And it has always been framed among certain people on the right as a means to protect the great integrity of this nation. In other words, to preserve its whiteness, to preserve its democracy and its free enterprise system for those who truly understand it and deserve it.
And we must remember that this is not just a focus on Spanish-speaking people, because every wave of immigrants, beginning with the Irish, was criticized as being un-American.
Yes.
Because they were Catholic, or whatever.
Lazy, dirty,
lazy,
stupid.
Lazy, dirty, yeah. Norwegians, Hungarians, hunkies, they were called. If you go to the history of a place like Butte, Montana, which was a community of workers who were mostly immigrants, every community had a negative name attached to it. We have always engaged in these things. We have always been anti-Semitic. We have always been anti-Catholic. We have always been anti-you name it, as long as it isn't seen as the American thing. And this is still a dominant force in American politics and awareness, despite innumerable examples of the enormous contribution that minorities, and in the case of Mexican-Americans in the region we're talking about, the majority, have made.
Okay. This is KBOO.
It is.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program. We're talking about immigration policy in the United States right now. We have, I think, one more piece to put into place here, and then we'll start taking phone calls.
Yeah, and I got to tell people it's 90.7 on the FM dial here in Portland, and you really do want to. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Urich.
Right.
You really do want to listen to us, because not because we're so good, but because what we're talking about is so important.
Right. It is really important, and I hope that will come through by the end of this discussion. 503-231-8187 is the phone number to call. Now, I talked about September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
What, broadly speaking, happened after September 11th, 2001?
I don't know. What?
We went collectively crazy. There was a giant reflexive and often violent and militant re-examining of our self-image, for lack of a better term. We created an enormous cabinet department called the Department of Homeland Security, which has itty-bitty fascist overtones, in my humble opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Homeland, the phrase Homeland Security is a frightening one. But at any rate, the old Immigration and Nationalization Service was rolled in to the Department of Homeland Security, and the enforcement of the border became a much more militarized, much more aggressive sort of undertaking. There was a reshifting of immigration priorities from simply identifying and possibly deporting people here without documentation to aggressively going after people who are supposedly here committing crimes. Criminal aliens is what the Department of Homeland Security calls them. Now, the funding for identifying and deporting so-called criminal aliens increased from about roughly $23 million a year in 2004 to $690 million a year in 2011.
Wow.
So in many cases, this became a solution in search of a problem. You've got all this money for aggressive border enforcement, so by God, you better start aggressively enforcing the border. The problem, according to the New York Times, is that about two-thirds of the nearly 2 million people deported under President Obama involve people who have committed only minor infractions, things like speeding tickets, nonviolent offenses, barely crimes at all. But under this new aggressive deportation of criminal aliens, they have been sent home.
Well, and the border has been essentially militarized. We now have drones patrolling the border.
There's
we now have a fence
under
unbelievable fences that are similar to the ones, by the way, that Israel has built to keep Arabs out of what is now claimed as Israeli land.
Yes.
I mean, the similarities there are very disturbing.
They are very disturbing. So what we have here instead of, and I must say that I'm guilty of the offense I'm about to describe. I think there are many among the progressive community who saw the nation's first African-American president and thought that there would be some sort of de facto change of heart, a more enlightened stance on immigration, because President Obama is a member of a traditionally underrepresented group, and he would, by his very nature, deal more compassionately with other members of other underrepresented groups.
Well, his father was an African.
Right. His father was an African, and his mother was a woman. That's another underrepresented group.
Yeah.
But that hasn't happened. As we just finished discussing, there have been almost two, or actually more now than 2 million people, a new record, deported under his watch. So this hasn't happened.
So one of the things that has happened, meanwhile, is that the movement, the vigorous out in the public eye movement that has characterized May Days beginning about 2000 and growing and growing and growing, have been demands, se se puede, we can, we will become part of this country. We are part of this country.
Yes, yes.
And this is to me a wonderful opportunity for cross-cultural and cultural merging, a wonderful opportunity to build a more solid, more varied America.
I would agree with that statement wholeheartedly.
But that's not the way a lot of people see this.
No, it's not. You would think that conservatives, anti-immigration conservatives, and by extension, anti-brown people conservatives, would be happy with the president's level of deportation. But surprisingly, they are not happy with that. There's been, you've probably heard about this many, many times over the past few years, there's been repeated calls for I'm making air quotes now, this is great radio, comprehensive immigration reform. Some way to come to grips with the border that is continually crossed, despite our attempts to militarize it, and to come to terms with the de facto situation in this country, which is that there is a massive underclass of undocumented workers in this country who do jobs that, by and large, most Americans won't do. And they do them at a wage that, by and large, most Americans won't accept. This is a fact. This is part of our economy. This is a major factor in why certain goods and services cost what they happen to cost. And any true reckoning with the immigration situation is going to have to involve a true reckoning with the economic situation. They are one and the same. And that is something I think that people on both sides of the aisle in Washington greatly fear.
I think this is true. I think that, you know, I think that we've never, ever, as a people, developed, even in our most wholesome traditions, ever really, really developed a sense that we are this and they are the other. We've never abandoned that. There's always this otherness, and it's distinguished based on looks, based on apparent cultural differences,
yes,
rather than on our similarities.
Language.
Language is very important. When I was coming up in Southern California, the other was very apparent. The notion of the Pachucos, the people who occasioned the great fear of the armed services during World War II when they were trying to get Mexican Americans into the armed forces, the idea of these gangs, these deadly teenage gangs, the Zoot Suit Riots, the Sleepy Lagoon Murders, all of this were archetypal ways of creating a sense of the other in Mexican Americans who were, for the most part, actually citizens of the United States.
Let's go to the phones.
Yeah, let's go to the phones.
Who do we have, Steve? Carlos, good morning.
Cool, all right. Okay, so I wanted to lay a few things out there
okay.
to kind of add to some of the timeline that you guys have been putting together. I'm glad that you guys are doing this topic. Like, there's more conversation that needs to be done. But first of all, I want to recommend a book that covers pretty much all this stuff here. It was like the first book that was ever done to kind of address a lot of this stuff. It's called Occupied America by Rodolfo Acuña. And it's basically like the first historical book on Chicano history.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes even before, it starts even before the Mexican-American War, or the American-Mexican War, I should say.
Yeah, really.
And expands, you know, up until current day. So get the most current edition, and it talks about all this stuff. But I wanted to make a point about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Not only guaranteed lands that people already owned in the area, in the areas that was formerly the northern half of Mexico. You know, so there were ranchers and farmers that were in those areas whose lands were taken, like literally taken. People had literally gone into the houses of these people and taken their land from them. It was also in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo also guaranteed their rights as citizens, the people that were already living in the United States at the time, or, you know, in that area at the time. So then jumping forward to the 50s, or actually the 40s and 50s, as far as the Pachucos go, The Zoot Suit Riots was actually a riot that was started by the Navy and by the local like armed forces and sheriffs and police off duty had rounded up a whole bunch of people to go in there and start gathering up pachucos and throwing them in jail.
That's right.
Actually, the victims
and stripping them of their Zoot Suits, tearing clothing off.
Annihilate,
of people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of rape as well. A lot of rape.
Yeah. A lot of rape. It was a psychological thing that they were doing by getting rid of tearing off the Zoot Suits. But then in the 50s, it was really interesting what you were mentioning there in the 50s. But in the 50s, there was a chief that had come into Los Angeles. So this addresses a lot of the racism as well. Chief Parker, I think it was William Parker.
Yeah.
Was instated there in Los Angeles, and he brought in a whole bunch of Southern whites into the police department, one of the things that he did was there was a very vibrant black community on Central Avenue, mm-hmm. in South Los Angeles, and there was same as the Harlem Renaissance was going on in South Los Angeles at the time. A lot of the musicians and poets famous folks that made the Harlem Renaissance an important part of history were also doing the same thing in Los Angeles. They wanted to break into Hollywood. And so they had something going on there. When Chief Parker came in, and so they had all of these clubs that ran along Central Avenue in Los Angeles that were becoming really, really popular, and they were black owned clubs. And they had a system of basically paying off the police before Chief Parker came. Chief Parker didn't like that white folks were coming from the suburbs into that area and mixing with black folks to basically enjoy the scene. He didn't like that, and so he started shutting all that down.
Oh,
basically,
my.
Basically decimating the whole
right. No, I'm really glad you reminded us of that, and I want to thank you for the call and for the confirmation of the value of what we're doing.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Thank you, Carlos. Very much. That was a great call.
Yeah. No, Carlos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Appreciate
man.
It, man.
Well, I mean, if I could just make one more point.
Okay. So sure.
At the same time, he was doing that. He also started rounding up the pachucos. He started rounding up, and this happened all over kind of the Southwest. They started throwing Chicanos and African Americans in jail in large numbers, and this was like one of the early periods of the first real big waves of incarcerating dark skinned folks, and that continues today. So that's the other point that I wanted to make, was that not only is Obama shipping folks back to other countries, they're also being incarcerated in really high rates, and they're being detained in like deportation centers. This
yes.
includes elderly folks, and it includes children.
About 30,000 people at the moment.
Yeah,
and I, once you brought that up, these deportation centers, these prisons, are most of them privately run. And the food is inadequate. The facilities are inadequate. They tried to put one in down by the river in the Southwest here, but the community objected to it, not for the best of reasons, but it didn't happen. And I do want to thank you for the call, man. I think it's important.
Right on.
Hey, thanks. You bet.
All right. I guess I didn't at the beginning say, and I guess I guess I better say it. In general, what we're trying to do is keep calls to 3 minutes, though that call was very valuable.
It was. Yeah, we'll be running the 3-minute timer from here on out.
So,
Carlos, you got the freebie call today, man.
Yeah, and that means that those of you calling in, you might want to compose your thoughts so they can fit within the 3-minute framework. This gives us an opportunity to have more callers.
It does. Yes.
So we're talking right now about immigration, about deportation, and about a larger question of the history of the United States and the seizure of a large part of Mexico, and of, in general, the endemic racism implicit in all of this, and our insistence upon our language being official language of America. You hear this all the time, is English.
And we're also talking about our tacit endorsement of the status quo, which, as I mentioned before, involves the existence of a permanent underclass who are paid less than minimum wage, who largely do jobs that American citizens don't want to do, and are unable, because of their undocumented status, to receive the benefits that their taxes pay for. And undocumented workers pay a lot of taxes, more than $11 billion in 2010 alone, according to a recent study.
Yeah, well, too bad.
Too bad.
Too bad.
All right, let's go to the phones. Brian, you're up next.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure I was on.
Yeah.
So this is Brian. And, you know, I just wanted to point out, you know, a couple things real quick. You know, the situation of racism in the country, I feel like it's gotten worse. I don't know. You know, I think a lot of people have come out openly racist, you know, since the
70s. we just had a crazy ex Green Beret murderous person attack two Jewish facilities and kill Christians.
I thought that was pretty funny. And in Kansas, no less. Right?
No, it was it Kansas?
Yeah,
it is Kansas. Yeah. Sorry.
So, you know, that's one point I want to make, and I think that the sad thing is we know what racism does to a society, and all I can imagine is, you know, we back in the 50s and the 60s, we didn't really have a grasp on that, but now we do, and we're allowing it to continue, or certain camps in the United States are promoting it, but those are the really wealthy people, you know, the Koch brothers and all that, who father was a founding member of the John Birch Society.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other point I'd really like to make is that if you went along the border, I know in the mid 2000s, in the strip malls above Juarez, or even if you went down to Juarez in the strip malls, you would find any number of big American corporations with recruiters, and they would recruit people to go to work for them. And it was pretty simple to, you know, one day go in, present an ID card, and the next day be on a bus up to Tennessee, Georgia, or even Iowa or Wyoming, you know, to work on farms or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, this is, you know, this was the source. It wasn't people straggling over the border with a gallon of water. You know, this is the way, you know, we got our immigrant labor, and we've been getting it that way for a long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mentioned the Bracero program, which was to bring huge numbers of Spanish-speaking laborers into the United States to pick our crops while our young men were off fighting World War II.
Exactly, and if you went to the, you know, the last few years, you know, they've been arresting, you know, large numbers of people who are immigrant labor. I bet most of them got a company bus up from, you know, a border town to
could well be the case.
Yes, exactly. And I wanna put in a little bizarro world here, okay?
Real quick,
and you guys can laugh it off.
Yeah, about 10 seconds.
But is the Border Patrol and the beefed up border meant to keep immigrants out, or is it meant to protect the drug cartels to bring drugs in?
Okay, on that note, we're going to let you go, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Bye-bye.
So, again, 3-minute limit. We're just trying. The reason why we're doing that is not because we hate you all, but rather because, because we really want to get as many voices in as possible. We're talking right now about the immigration issue and about the history of the United States with regard to Mexico and other immigrant communities. And we really, and racism is a general issue in this context. And we really do want to hear from you. 231-8187.
Garrett, good morning.
Hi. I was actually wondering if you might think that our current immigration system is merely just a modern form of slavery, that the same tactics are being used, and it's fear to control a workforce. The difference is that they're a slightly lighter shade of brown than they were before, but the updates in the systems of control being used are the same as the updates to any other systems that we've had running. We changed the language, but we still use violence.
I hesitate to make that direct comparison because as inherently unequal and oppressive as this current underclass situation is, it does not involve the ownership of human beings by other human beings. So it's not slavery. And while there are many facets of it that are coercive, it is not slavery. And a lot of people,
they please, especially with the detaining them for up to a year or two just to make money off of them, they have no rights.
Well, yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Well, you're talking about the incarceration system.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. But the system of labor that exists, I mean, there are wages being paid, despite the fact that they are illegally low, and despite the fact that benefits are not offered, and despite the fact that the people who receive the wages are not entitled to the benefits that every other wage-earning American.
They're also under threat of deportation if they offer resistance to their
employers. They are, yes, but slavery, no, it's not.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call, and I think it raises though the specter of lack of free labor, lack of true freedom for labor, and I think that is
important.
Oh,
indeed, yeah.
I think that's very important. So we're talking about the situation of immigrants and the incredible amount of deportation under the Obama administration, and of a history of the United States as a country that took over a vast part of traditionally Spanish and Mexican lands, and the people therein.
And let's not forget the status quo, which we all tacitly endorse. I got to keep repeating that. Until we change it, that means that officially we're all willing to live with it, right? The presence of undocumented workers who are paid less than a minimum wage or less than a prevailing wage for a given occupation, the presence of those people, and I don't mean those people, drives down the wages for similarly skilled citizens. So there's a depressive effect on wages because of the underclass that we permit to exist.
You know, and I hadn't really thought about that for this show, but that's really true. This is part of the mechanism that keeps so many people underpaid and underfed in our society.
Indeed. And that's why I think a lot of this dithering about comprehensive immigration reform is just that. It's dithering. Look at all the industries that benefit from being able to hire people at less than minimum wage. Agriculture, obviously, the food services industry, construction, and on and on and on. All of these industries depend on people that they can pay off the books.
Yeah, or less than the prevailing wage, which means essentially not a living wage.
Right. Exactly. All right. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, an alternative radio biologist and professor Sandra Steingraber speaks on contamination without consent. Yuck. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10, Flashpoints features a powerful speech by the late writer Gore Vidal, recorded in Berkeley in 1994. At 11, on stage and studio, guest host Sarika Mehta talks with Dominican-American writer Julia Alvarez about her memoir, A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with architectural writer Brian Libby and the architects Peter Meyer and Becca Cavell. They will talk about the Portland Building, Memorial Coliseum, and the Gasco Building on Highway 30, and whether there's a case for preserving such Portland landmarks. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Okay, now, number to call, 231-8187. We're going to remind you of the three-minute limit so we can get as many calls in as possible. And we're talking about deportation. We're talking about immigrant labor. We're talking about the whole failure, I think clearly, the failure of the Obama administration to live up to the implicit, if not explicit, promise to be more just in its dealings with people who come from, whose families even, not necessarily them, come from south of the border.
All right, who's next, Steve? Barth, good morning.
Good morning, all. I think you're giving him a little too much credit. It's not just his failure to live up to the implicit promises, but in fact, the direct working against those promises. The toll is now over 2 million people that he has caused to be deported. Your last caller talked about a permanent underclass and slavery, the equivalency of slavery, and with people going to immigration prison and immigration detention centers and lots of people being incarcerated for minor crimes, that feeds right into the prison industrial complex, where people earn a dollar a day to actually produce goods that are sold commercially.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them. So I think that essentially is equatable to a slavery situation. They have no rights.
Yes, I would agree with you that the prison industrial situation, yes, can be is more comparable to slavery than the general phenomenon of underpaid undocumented laborers.
Well, but the other side of underpaid and undocumented, which has come to light in Portland by various lawsuits of restaurant workers and other things, people are hired, they have no papers, or they have false papers, and then they're exploited where they are drastically underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the regular wage, their wages are not paid, so they have wage theft. They have no ability to protest, and when they do, they're turned over to immigration or just discarded. And your talk about that diluting the wage structure for regular workers and people in the local underclass who are citizens but are pushed into no future jobs, you know, McDonald's and Walmart and et cetera, where they are going to be a permanent underclass.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the people that are benefiting, the structures that are benefiting from this are the same ones that are changing the laws to make themselves more powerful. The Koch brothers that you mentioned, and Walmart, and et cetera, where if you have a permanent class of people that are hungry and you get 2,000 people to come and sign up for 50 jobs when you open a new big box store, you know, that's great for them because anybody that's uppity or non-compliant can just be discarded.
We're going to try to stick to the three-minute limit.
Fair enough. I think that's a good idea.
I think your call is very important, and I appreciate it.
Good day.
Hey.
All right.
All right. We are talking about the situation of, and I think we can broaden the discussion to the vast underclass of individuals who are disproportionately persons whose first language is Spanish.
I want to make one more point that's very important to me personally before we go back to our callers.
Sure.
And that is I really object to the way that undocumented immigrants are broadly characterized on the right. They are characterized as lazy, as somehow uncivilized, who come here simply to take advantage of the bounty of America, who are secretly have some agenda. And this is true. What I'm saying here is true. These are actually paranoid fantasies on the right that have an agenda to reestablish the old Mexican homeland, to take back those portions of Mexico that were forcefully annexed by the United States, to make everybody speak Spanish, and on and on and on. It's all just incredibly racist and incredibly condescending. And it ignores one very, very important fact. If you are from someplace like Mexico or like Guatemala or whatever, and you are looking at a situation that offers you very few options, very few opportunities economically, and you're looking north to the United States of America, which is a land of incredible wealth and bounty, and you are willing to take the incredible risk to life and limb to get yourself from wherever you are into the United States simply so that you have the opportunity to work and to get ahead and maybe send a little money back to your family, I say those are the kind of people we want in this country. That kind of initiative, that willingness to take risks, that level of drive, those are the people we want here.
Well, I agree with you, and I think this is an important topic that should be on all of our minds right now. And right now, as rents go sky high, as the large banking firms, et cetera, take over houses that people have lost in the Great Recession, and then turn those around as rental properties with incredibly higher rents than can be afforded, which means that people have to crowd up into these places. We're seeing in our society a pattern where we're creating a permanent underclass that's made up both of the working classes, traditional working classes, and of the middle classes. And this is a pattern that we will see from one generation to the next until we are really, I believe, really in a situation in which there will be a 1% of 1% who are vastly wealthy and the great majority of us vastly poor.
I think we're pretty much there.
No, we're getting there. All right, we want to hear from you. 231-8187.
Francis, good morning.
Hey, racism has been a valuable tool for the mongrels for hundreds of years.
For whom?
It hasn't stopped now.
It's been a tool for whom?
The Koch brothers or people of their like.
Yeah. Okay.
I just checked out a book. I'm scared to read it. It's called How the Irish Became White.
Mm.
And it speaks to the racism that Irish people encountered.
Yeah, it's a good book.
In the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but it talks about how a lot of the Irish immigrants acquired the white supremacy activities or started doing them in order to become legitimate or to feel that they were accepted.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Irish because, you know, Francis, you know that the first group extremely stereotyped in negative ways following the British
right.
pattern were the Irish who came here in large numbers.
Uh-huh. But my point is that, you know, the gentleman spoke of slavery. Right now, this prison industrial complex owns people. That's what slavery is. It's the ownership of people. And all the inmates in those prisons are collateral. So we do have New Age slavery going on right now. I think it's interesting how we focus on one man, President Obama. I can remember after he got elected, the next day after he had the meeting, my son said to me, "Well, Mama, they talked to him. I can see it on his face." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "He's only going to be able to do what they let him do." And if you look at how this Congress has responded to our president, it is nothing but racism. And we need to really acknowledge that and deal with it now while our president is still with us and hasn't already gone, I'm not saying deceased, but is no longer the president.
Right.
We need to stand up behind him now, not wait till 20 years from now. Oh, man, look what they did. That's what we do all the time. We need to stand up behind him now because we know what he said in those speeches. We know he meant what he said in those speeches.
Well, we're not sure he meant what he
not,
said.
He meant every word. I read his book, the first one. He meant every word. What is happening is they are not allowing him to do anything. And we need to stand behind him and acknowledge that that's what's happening. He can't do it. They'll just say he's playing the race card. So we need to. Thank you.
Thank you very much for
the call,
Francis. All right, 231-8187.
All right, a quick comment to what Francis just said. There is no doubt that there is a rampant and virulent strain of irrational Obama hatred amongst many on the right, and many of those people sit in the United States Congress, and they are going to oppose him no matter what he does, even if he deports 2 million brown people. They're not going to give him a pat on the back.
Well, and I also think it's fundamentally racist. I think she's not wrong about
that.
She's
not wrong about that, and she's not wrong that he has faced an unprecedented level of obstructionism. And I'm not. That's not just hyperbole, I should say that isn't hyperbole. It's true, an unprecedented level of obstructionism. So that she's right as far as that goes. But then I look at something like the 2 million people that his administration has deported. That didn't have to happen. He could have put a stop to that. So to say unequivocally that he has meant every word he's ever said in public or in writing, I don't know that we know that's true.
I think there are two things going on here. I think there is the centrist, which now is very much right wing, phenomenon in American politics, of which Obama is clearly part. The decision to not simply extend Medicare, Medicaid to all people, because that would have meant that the insurance industry would have suffered.
Right.
And the complicated, ensuing complicated health plan. A lot of other things show accommodation to the system of a very reactionary capitalism that characterizes our society at this time. At the same time, I think that the yearnings and the expression of idealism that Obama made in his books and in his speeches was, from his point of view, very real. So we have the contradiction of the man's ideals with the man's actions, with the situation in the United States, where we really do have a very reactionary form of government and a very reactionary Congress.
Yes, I agree. But that said, we also cannot ignore the fact that the mere fact that we elected an African American to the presidency twice is indicative of a sea change in the American body politic. That would not have been possible even a couple of decades ago.
That's certainly true. Let's go to the phones. 231-8187.
Pascal, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to make a little correction. From what I understand, it sounded as if the sending back immigrants for minor offenses dated to the Homeland Security creation. I remember very clearly that in 1996, Congress passed very restrictive laws against immigrants. So it's much older than the 2001.
Yeah. I did not mean to imply that this was brand new beginning in the post-September 11th era. I'm saying that it intensified.
Okay, because that's one of the reasons I became a citizen, and I don't want to say that I was planning to commit a minor offense, but it was alarming to me because it basically showed that being a legal immigrant was not even desirable.
Right.
Right. No, I know many people, actually Europeans who came here, who made the decision to become citizens shortly after 9/11 because they saw the handwriting on the wall.
And also, just like me, at the time, I'm sure that many other people became citizens. And I remember reading in the newspaper something about so many people loved the United States so much that they decided to become citizens in huge amounts. Well, it was because of that 1996 law.
Mm-hmm.
That's, just wanted to point that out.
No, I appreciate that. And I think your point is very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the
call.
Thank
you very much.
All right. We are talking about the deportation of huge numbers of people who speak Spanish as their first language. And we're talking about the failure of the United States to acknowledge the value and worthiness of these many, many people who come to the United States to do the work, as my partner Abe points out, that a lot of Americans simply don't want to do. 231-8187 is the number to call.
Indeed. Richie. Did I get that right, Richie? BT, no, I'm sorry, BT. Go
right.
Ahead.
Yeah, well, let's see if I can try to get these two quick points in. Now, I think for the deportations, I could be wrong, but I think I recall reading that the Obama administration has been counting turning away people at the border as a deportation when earlier administrations would not count those as deportations. So to kind of increase the number.
I saw that in an article. I think that's to some degree true, but I think it ignores the vast majority of deportations.
So I said they may be going on, but I'm just talking about like inflated numbers. Now, on the history, you know, everyone talks about, Mexico was taken. You're counting California, Nevada, of New Mexico. Is that really Spain when Spain...
No, that's Mexico.
It was Mexico.
That was Mexico. Hey, I have to interrupt you because we've run out of time. We'll take up this topic in another date. Thank you very much. You all stay tuned to KBOO 90.7 your FM dial. Remember, we are your radio station.
But it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirect.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, biologist and professor Sandra Steingraber speaks on contamination without consent. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a powerful speech by the late writer Gore Vidal, recorded in Berkeley in 1994. At 11 on Stage and Studio, guest host Sarika Mehta talks with Dominican-American writer Julia Alvarez about her memoir, A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with architectural writer Brian Libby and the architects Peter Mayer and Becca Cavell. They will talk about the Portland Building, Memorial Coliseum, and the Gas Company Building on Highway 30, and whether there is a case for preserving such Portland landmarks. Thank you, KABU members, for supporting this community radio station. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one at kboo.fm. Just click on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Your Honor, I am not a lawyer. I'm a biologist and a human being. I am also the mother of a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old, and I bring all of these identities into your courtroom tonight. I am guilty of an act of trespass. On March 18th, I willfully stood on private property owned by the energy company and blocked access to a compressor station that is being constructed in order to prepare explosive hydrocarbon gases, propane and butane, for storage in abandoned salt caverns that are located beside and beneath Seneca Lake. In my field of environmental health, the word trespass has meaning. Toxic trespass refers to involuntary human exposure to a chemical or other pollutant. It is contamination without consent.
That's Sandra Steingraber, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Sandra Steingraber on contamination without consent. When faced with injustice, what options are open to people? Turn away and ignore it, or confront it? The destruction of the environment is an injustice. We are turning parts of the earth into a toxic waste dump. What comforts are we willing to give up to protect Mother Nature? Will we make real sacrifices, or simply kick the ball down the road and be content with placebos like shopping differently? The planet is facing a medical emergency. In response, activists are sitting in, chaining themselves to fences and blocking roads. Some, like Sandra Steingraber, go to jail in upstate New York in protest of fracking. My small nonviolent act, she says, is set against a larger, more violent one, the trespass of hazardous chemicals into water and air, and thereby into our bodies. This is a form of toxic trespass. It is contamination without consent. Our guest today is Sandra Steingraber. She's a biologist, professor, writer, and environmental health expert. She's a leading voice on alerting the public to toxic trespassing and the dangers posed by fracking. She's the author of Living Downstream and Raising Elijah. She spoke at Worcester State University in Worcester, Massachusetts. And now, Sandra Steingraber.
I am indeed an author and a biologist, but I'll begin today by speaking out of another identity, that as a civil disobedient. From a column I wrote for Orion magazine entitled Coffee in Jail. There is no coffee in the Chemung County Jail. There used to be coffee. Also, parenting classes, drug counseling, and the opportunity to purchase from the jailhouse commissary packages of new underwear. But the new sheriff put a stop to all that. So said the women of cell block 5D at about 6:30 a.m. I myself had become a woman of cell block 5D at about 3:30 a.m., so the coffee situation caught my attention. The fact that I found it more alarming than the underwear situation says something about me that my mother would not find admirable. The Chemung County Jail is located in Elmira, which is situated wholly within the Chemung River floodplain along New York's border with Pennsylvania. Elmira was once the writing home of Mark Twain. Now here was a fact to inspire me. But the city is otherwise most famous for repeated flooding and for its notorious prison camp. Fully one quarter of the 12,000 captured Confederate soldiers that were held as inmates in Elmira died here during the final months of the Civil War. My fellow inmates looked in at me through the bars of my cell and continued their briefing. Until tested for tuberculosis, all incoming prisoners are classified as keep lock, which is to say they have to remain inside their cells. The TB test takes 48 hours to administer and read, but medical personnel are not always available. Budget cuts, baby. Thus, new admits can end up in 24/7 keep lock for up to 15 business days, pursuant to 7013.8B of the New York Penal Code. 15 days was the entire length of my sentence. "Look," said the inmate named Nadine, "we'll be bringing you meals and stuff. What do you need?" Part 1. In early February, the New England nature writer Maxine Cumin died. She was the poet laureate of New Hampshire and also held that same post for the whole nation in the early 1980s, although they called it something different then. Her New York Times obituary noted that Cumin was famous for insisting that her students commit long chunks of verse to memory, at least 30 to 40 new lines every week. The goal, she said, and here the Times quotes her from an interview she gave in 2000, was to provide students a better appreciation of the sound of poetry, as well as offer them, quote, an internal library to draw on when they are taken political prisoner. The Times continues, "For many," said Cumin, "this is an unthinkable concept. They simply do not believe in anything fervently enough to go to jail for it." Those words were spoken 14 years ago. So to start us off this evening, I have two questions for you. So take out pencil and paper because I'd like you to actually write these down. And I'm talking to everyone here, not just students. Here's the first question. So one word answer. Do you think Maxine Cumin's words are still true today? That is, for college students in the year 2014, does lack of conviction make imprisonment beyond the bounds of thinkable thought? Is there still nothing worth going to jail for? What do you think? Yes or no? All right, now let's turn the mirror around and answer this question for yourself. Would you willingly break a law and risk jail time for any issue? If so, what would it be? So that's a